This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of August 16th, 2021, brought to you by Resultant, formerly KSM Consulting. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Nobody wants to end up in the emergency room, but it happens. If you fall off a ladder or drop a kitchen appliance on your foot, an ambulance might be in order. And if you go that route and obviously assume the risk of getting saddled with a big bill for the service, you might assume that you'd go to the nearest hospital or hospital of your choice. Sadly, you should prepare yourself for the possibility of a longer ride. You might have to go clear across Indianapolis or even into a neighboring city instead of the nearest hospital. At emergency rooms across central Indiana, no vacancy signs are flashing at unprecedented rates. Emergency rooms are often overflowing with patients, prompting hospitals to divert ambulances to other hospitals for hours at a stretch, provided the cases aren't life-threatening. It's the latest indication that local and area hospitals are struggling with a growing nursing shortage, and to a lesser extent, that the pandemic is roaring back to life. As you're about to hear, it is very difficult to pin hospitals down on just how often this has been happening in recent months. But IBJ's John Russell has been in close contact with Central Indiana's healthcare systems and hospital administrators throughout the pandemic. He has filed a revealing report on ambulance diversions for IBJ's latest issue, and John is our guest this week to share his reporting. Here's our conversation. I'm helping to welcome back to the podcast John Russell, who covers healthcare for IBJ. John, thanks so much for making time today.
So good to be back.
So paint me a picture, put me in an ambulance. Let's say I have been cleaning the gutters and I fall off the ladder. My right foot is now turned the wrong way. It is swelled up like a balloon. My wife calls an ambulance. Now, I live kind of around Broadripple. The obvious place for me to go is Community North or IU North. But you're saying I potentially could end up going across town or maybe even to, like, to Johnson County or Hancock County if hospitals are on diversion.
Or to Muncie or to any other city within an hour or so. It could happen. Although in the case you just described, that sounds kind of serious if you maybe have a broken bone or something life-threatening if you fall off a ladder. So I pray that that's just a scenario. Diversions are just going crazy these days. So maybe I should step back and describe what a diversion is. All hospitals have the power to put out an alert to EMS that we're backed up, our emergency rooms are full, we've got a two-hour wait, we have no beds here, we're putting people on gurneys in the hall, there's no beds upstairs for the patients we need to admit. We need some breathing time. So we're going to put out what's called a diversion for 2 hours, 3 hours, 6 hours, which means please don't come to our hospital unless it's a huge emergency. And what you just described sounds like a medium emergency. So yes, you may be taken to a hospital across town, which is open.
So if it's really serious, maybe I was in a car accident or I have really intense chest pains, the possibility of me going to the nearest hospital ASAP are much better.
I think so, yes. Now, diversions are not one size fits all. Some hospitals will say, we just need to put out a diversion for burn patients, or we need to put out a diversion for, you know, bumps and scratches, or we need to put out a diversion for psychiatric patients. We don't have the specialists or the beds or the staffing for those kinds of things, but we can take other kinds of things. And certainly, you know, a heart attack that as you just described, I think they would let you in.
So this is a message that goes out to EMS, that goes out to ambulance services. Does that mean that I would maybe be smarter to try to walk in myself?
You might be, yeah, because I've not heard of a hospital that turns down or closes the door to a walk-in. In fact, hospitals are required to treat anyone who shows up in the emergency room. So if you walk in, there's no way that they could have waved you off in advance as they would an ambulance. And the difference is the ambulance driver does not want to sit there and wait for an hour to be let in. He's going to look for the next nearest hospital. It's both for in the interests of his patient and the interests of his ambulance service.
Yeah, and that's right. And that's something that a nuance I'm not sure everybody gets. I mean, a lot of ambulance services are independent, like small businesses, essentially, or medium-sized businesses. They're not employed by the hospital systems, and they're there to make money.
They are. And there's several different kinds of ambulance systems. Some of them exist just to do routine bread and butter runs between nursing homes, say, and a local clinic for dialysis care or for chemotherapy or just general check-ins. And then there's another whole crop of ambulances which exist to do the emergency runs. And in central Indiana, the largest one is the Marion County EMS. But there are a number of smaller ones around the area, which are privately owned in many cases and don't need to be backed up waiting in a hospital, you know, parking lot for an hour or two when they could be, you know, on their next run.
So we know diversions are happening, but do we really have a sense of how common this is or how much more common it has become, say, in the last couple of months?
I have a sense, but it's tough for the public to get a sense. And the only way I have a sense is because I talked to my sources at all the hospitals for a story I wrote this week. They told me, you know, for example, that IU Health said their number of diversion hours in July was triple the number in May or June. Community said they often are doing runs between their hospitals and the network. Franciscan said they're up on diversion about a third of the time lately compared to, say, 5% normally. There's no way for the public to get that information. You're not going to get it from the switchboard if you call a hospital. And there's no reporting agency. There's no reporting requirements. Good luck finding it. And that's a whole, you know, can of worms in itself.
Wow. Why not? You know, why wouldn't there be some sort of reporting requirement? I mean, this sounds like something that's certainly significant for the patient.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And most states just don't have one. Massachusetts is one of the few states that has that kind of requirement. 49 other states, including Indiana, don't. Now, some hospitals have a collaborative partnership where they set up this public-private little agency. And in Indiana, it's called the Mesh Coalition, which tracks ambulance traffic and diversions and has all the data apparently on hand, but considers it private and proprietary and won't share it with outside people or, you know, with me or with the public, which means it's a secret. And it means it's very controversial because it's a public health issue, public safety issue. So why is this information not being shared with the public? I would advocate that it should be. And so do a lot of public health officials that I talk to.
Have we heard any stories or have any evidence of instances where somebody was diverted and their condition significantly deteriorated when they had to go to a different place, or God forbid, they actually passed away?
You know, I haven't heard of anything like that in Indiana lately. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel had an interesting series 2 years ago on this topic, in which they did find people who died, people who deteriorated, people who were diverted and their ambulance trip took dozens and dozens of miles and more than an hour in some cases to get them to another emergency room and to a doctor. Those types of newspaper investigations take months to dig into. You know, it's possible that that's happening here. We just haven't heard about it.
Wow, that was really chilling. So what is the reason? Why is this happening? Why are hospitals diverting ambulances at a much greater rate?
Right. So diversion has been one of the rules of the game for a long time, and they've been doing it forever. But the reason it's increasing so much lately is hospitals are just so short-staffed, especially with nurses. A lot of nurses have burned out, so doctors and other patient care folks like therapists and technicians and EKG folks. Every hospital I talk to has a huge shortage of nurses. They've been promoted. They've taken jobs with outside agencies. They've gone into supervisory roles, and they're just not being replaced in their primary role, which is a floor nurse. or an emergency room nurse, which is what's causing the problem. Without that, some hospitals are taking beds out of service, or it's just taking longer and longer for one nurse to handle that many more patients. So, yeah, I mean, it all comes down to fewer nurses, meaning, you know, fewer places to see a patient.
Well, that just boggles my mind. I mean, you always have this sense that, you know, the hospitals are like, you know, the highest standard of care, and that they're always going to be ready for you. And it's just amazing to me that you could run out of nurses.
It is, yeah. I mean, I talk to doctors and nurses and administrators almost every day, so I'm in a little bubble and I can see it happening. I see the burnout. I see the feelings of being overwhelmed by COVID, which is another factor, although not as great in this case. But it's coming. There's a surge coming and it's gathering strength. God forbid, you know, we need our hospitals to be at top capacity again, and they're just not going to until they get fully staffed again.
Yeah, when I heard that you were first working on the story, I just assumed that the reason why hospitals were diverting was because the emergency rooms were just packed with people with a Delta variant, but that isn't necessarily the case.
You know, COVID is on the rise with the Delta variant, no doubt. Hospitalizations are triple what they were a month or two ago, but it's nowhere near what it was in November, December, when we were at the peak. Not to say we can't get back at the peak and even get higher. Some folks saying that, you know, that's a doomsday scenario that they hope doesn't come. There's COVID on one side and a staffing shortage on the other side, and that's not a pretty picture.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The right data and technology solution can transform your business. KSM Consulting is now Resultant and still passionate about solving problems no one else can. Still collaborating with our clients to find the best answer, not the easy answer. Visit Resultant.com to see what's possible for your organization.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. We're talking with reporter John Russell about the increase in ambulance diversions from Central Indiana hospitals. Tell me about, you know, speaking of doomsday scenarios, tell me about July 26th, a day that will live in infamy in Indianapolis hospital annals. How many hospitals went on diversion at some point that day in Central Indiana?
There were at least 10 big hospitals in Central Indiana that went on diversion at some point, according to the Marion County EMS. Those include some of the biggest hospitals in the region: Methodist, Community North and South, Eskenazi, Franciscan, IU North, and so on. It's one thing for a hospital to be out of service once, twice, but and here and there, but for hospitals everywhere to be out of service, where are you going to take your patients? You're going to take them here, most likely, because when all hospitals are on diversion, no hospitals are on diversion. That's the sort of the old saying. You just can't say there's no room at any end. You've got to take them somewhere. It's very rare that you have to take them 100 miles away. Could happen, but I haven't heard those stories.
So people on that day, they were all seen, as far as we know. I mean, they all did get emergency treatment because, as you said at the beginning, in the end, you can't turn people away.
Yeah, I wasn't in those ambulances, obviously. I wasn't in those emergency rooms, but I would not be surprised if some of those patients were waiting hours and hours to be seen unless they had the most serious conditions. They were probably, some of them, sitting there waiting overnight. Even if they were treated and admitted, they were probably waiting another, oh God, who knows, to get, you know, a bed upstairs. It's not a great time to be a patient in a hospital in Central Indiana.
Was there something about that day? As I recall, that was a Monday. Yeah. I don't know if that means anything.
Good question. I don't know what happened, if there was a common reason. There was no huge events. There was no huge announcement. There was no major outbreak reported that day. I think it was just one of those perfect storm, weird days where a lot of little things are happening. If anybody knows different, please let us know.
So what are hospitals trying to do to address this problem?
They're mostly going at the staffing shortage by trying to recruit as many and hire as many nurses as quickly as possible. IU Health, for example, is doing an aggressive recruiting campaign and raising salaries by double-digit percentages, I think, for nurses, and raising the minimum wage even for the lower level of entry-level workers, such as cafeteria, custodial, those kinds of folks, just to try and keep this staffing situation under control. Other hospitals are paying top dollar to hire agency nurses, you know, which can come, you know, which can cost three or four times a nurse's hourly rate that they're used to paying. I mean, it's a great time to be a nurse. Everyone wants you. You can write your own ticket. I mean, because they're all in the same boat. They're all chasing the same small pool.
Is this something that is affecting all hospital systems equally, you think, or is one struggling with it more than the others?
That goes back to the secret data we were talking about a little while ago. It's hard to say. And they're not going to say, oh, we're the worst off. You know, we're getting our butts kicked worse than any other hospital. You need to really find the numbers. And I would use this occasion to say that there should be a reporting requirement that's transparent and open to the public. So we can see who's hurting the worst, who's coping the best, where I should go as a patient or an ambulance driver. Those things are not doing anyone any good in a black box.
One of the stats that I know that they do need to report, they're required to report, is readmissions. That's one of my favorite stats to see. People who go to the hospital, get released, but then have to go back. That's a great example of a stat that they have to report that is really valuable to know.
It is. And that's been a requirement of Medicare for the last 7 or 8 years as part of Obamacare, I believe. Yeah, there's this feeling that if you as a hospital are seeing a high number of patients coming back after you've discharged them and they're coming back within a month, there's a problem. Okay, it can happen now and then. But so hospitals have a great incentive, a huge incentive in the face of possible loss of millions of dollars in Medicare fees to make sure that their patients are fully treated before they're discharged, that they coordinate with it. Other hospitals and aftercare facilities to make sure the patients are taken care of and to follow up with a nurse or a visiting nurse, do everything they can to keep this patient from returning. So you're right. It is a good example. And maybe Medicare could get involved in some way. Although that was part of a huge law that happened two presidential administrations ago in a much different Congress under very extreme circumstances. It would probably be a minor miracle to have it happen again, but it should happen.
Here's a complication related to COVID-19 that I think is really interesting. Now, hospital systems have begun to lay down the law in terms of mandating that their staffs get vaccinated. And I assume some could find that they're in the position where they need to fire reluctant staffers, which potentially could make the diversion phenomenon worse.
That is going to be really interesting to see next month, which is the deadline at several major big hospital systems here for employees to show that they've been fully vaccinated. They cannot afford to be losing dozens of patient care workers. Will they follow through on their threats to terminate them if they're not vaccinated? Oh, who can say? I mean, some hospitals have fired nurses in the past who refused to get the flu vaccination, but that was under less extreme circumstances, not in the middle of a pandemic and not during a huge staffing shortage. If I were a betting man, I would not be putting my money on either side of this equation.
Now, I know that nearly every decree during the pandemic has been challenged in court. Do we have a sense of how hospital workers might fare if they sued for being fired for not following a vaccination mandate?
There hasn't been a case in Indiana yet, although there was a case for the hospital system in Texas where several employees, a big hospital system in Houston, took it to court and they lost on every count, I believe, which really sent a national message that judges weren't likely to look favorably on these objections.
Just recently, as the Delta variant has created more infections, getting our daily report from the State Health Department has become a bit of an event in the newsroom. What, in your mind, is the most troubling statistic or development over the last few weeks since the variant cases have become the dominant COVID cases in Indiana?
Yeah, what I'm looking at is hospitalizations and ICU and ventilator capacity. Hospitals still look like they have a lot of capacity. All they have to do is shut down elective surgeries and they'll open hundreds of beds across central Indiana, which may not be too far off. By the way, that's another reason the overcrowding is happening now, is because patients who put off a lot of their elective procedures last year are coming back this year to have them done, you know, minor surgeries, outpatient surgeries, non-emergency care. That may have to be kicked down the road a little bit even more. Plenty of give in the system still at this point, but we know how quickly that can change. Mm-hmm. I mean, last spring, people were getting alarmed. Some people were freaking out. I mean, some cities were getting stretched. Some cities now are getting stretched. I'm reading about cities in the unvaccinated parts of the country, Alabama and Mississippi, which are running out of beds, running out of ICU capacity. It's not unquestionable. It's not out of the question, rather, that these things can happen and turn on a moment's notice.
Well, that's a happy note to end on. Well, thanks so much for taking time to review your reporting with me. I think this is really valuable stuff.
Great. And once again, let's get local lawmakers or policymakers or whoever it is to make sure that all this information that's being held secret is shared with the public.
My thanks again to John Russell. Again, you can check out his story on this topic in the latest issue of IBGA. And before you get on with the rest of your week, I want to draw your attention to a few other strong stories. Everything old is new again in retail, and the latest tried and true concept to make a comeback is the monthly subscription service. Susan Orr reports that several Indianapolis-based food and beverage retailers have launched services that let customers pay in advance for regular deliveries of everything from coffee cake to cigars. Also in this week's issue, Leslie Bonilla-Muniz explains how Indigo has found an intermediate step between its current fleet and an all-electric transit system, ordering $26 million in hybrid buses. And Mickey Shuey takes stock of Roger Penske's progress so far in upgrading the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and reinvigorating the IndyCar series. Again, you can read all of these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say it is quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited, well, by me this week, Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.